Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that gives us an opportunity to meet people who make a difference in our communities and in our lives. I'm your host, Bob Willard, and today our guest is harpist Suzanne McDonald, Distinguished Professor of Music and Head of the Harp Department at Indiana University's School of Music. For the next hour or so, we'll ask Suzanne a few questions, play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Suzanne, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you very much, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Suzanne, let me introduce you to our listeners by mentioning some of your accomplishments. Suzanne has made an indelible mark on the music world as one of the most important and influential harpists of the 21st century. She was the first American to win first prize in harp from the Paris Conservatory. At age 23, she made her Carnegie Hall debut and has since then had an incredible career as a solo recitalist and a guest soloist with the world's greatest orchestras. She has made recordings of the major harp repertoire as well as published volumes of her arrangements and original compositions for harp. Suzanne is currently head of the largest harp department in the United States at Indiana University, where she holds the rank of Distinguished Professor of Harp. Previous harp departments at Juilliard, University of Southern California, and University of Arizona. In 1989, Suzanne founded the USA International Harp Competition, making it the first major international harp competition in the United States. It is a competition open to all world-class harpists of all nationalities ages 16 to 23. The competition is held every 3 years. The fifth triannual competition will be held, and at the time of this taping, July 4th to 15th, right here at Indiana University, Bloomington. Suzanne, let's get into the competition. Tell us about the history and goals of the harp competition.
I had served as a member of the jury of many, many harp competitions, most of which were just a one-time thing. Munich had an international harp competition just once. Rome had one just once. Gargiles was ongoing in France and then stopped. And, of course, the big one was Israel, the international harp competition. And as I served on these juries, I realized that the IU School of Music here in Bloomington was ideally suited to host such a competition. We have a large number of excellent instruments. We have the practice facilities. Now we have such incredible recital halls, all very suited to the harp. And I knew in the summertime we had a symphony orchestra. So I began to dream of having just once an international harp competition in the United States. I also felt it would be a wonderful thing to not have to go abroad to experience an international competition and also to encourage foreigners to come to the United States. But as we began to plan the first international harp competition here, I realized it's very hard to ask people to give funding for an event that's just a one-time occasion. And so very, very rapidly it became apparent that we should make this an ongoing competition, similar to the violin international competition in Indianapolis. And by the way, those people encouraged me greatly to do this and felt that IU was a marvelous locale in which to hold the first USA International Harp Competition. So we started, and I am very thrilled and proud that we're now going to have our fifth competition. And I think I can safely say, Bob, that we are really the number one now in the world, that harpists aspire to come here. We're the wealthiest. We have the finest prizes. We have the finest concert engagements and now CD recordings. Our winners now will be presented in Tully Hall in New York, in London, in Paris, in Tokyo, in Seattle. And really, my goal is to really help a very worthwhile, deserving young artist to give them a hand up and to really help them have a career as a solo harpist.
Is this the same kind of kickstart that you got from winning the prize in Paris?
Perhaps, but I think the world has changed so much since then, and a competition is even more fierce, I think. And I think it's more and more difficult to have a solo concert career on any instrument. So that I feel it's perhaps this is even more helpful for For one thing, the winner will win in this competition a one-of-a-kind concert harp designed specifically for this competition, valued at about $55,000.
Wow.
And that's a big hand up for a young artist to have a superb instrument like that. And I think the concert engagements that will already give them some name recognition all over the world is an incredible boost. When I after I came back from Paris, one of the things that I did, my manager in New York said, you know, just one harp recital is not that, it doesn't make that much of an impact. And she said, I think what you should do is you should do three harp recitals in 1 week of all original music for the harp. This will make a real impact in the New York musical world. So whatever she asked me to do, I thought, well, that's what I'll do, and I did it. And lo and behold, the week of my three recitals, I played Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Different program every night, all original compositions for the harp. All the New York newspapers were on strike for the entire week. So the only reviews were in the trade journals. I remember Musical America and some of the other trade journals followed it and reviewed it favorably. But that was really not a help.
Now, the goals of the competition are to provide an opportunity experience for these young harpists to play in front of actually each other and a professional jury.
That's right. And they have to, you know, play a very difficult repertoire, demanding repertoire, that will climax with the final, with orchestra, where only three, they'll be eliminated then down to three contestants. And all three of them will play the Ginastera Harp Concerto with our orchestra. And that will be a very, very exciting night.
So they have a required repertoire. You actually have an original piece, too, for it, don't you?
Yes. We have a piece by Michael Leiss, an American composer, called The Dilling Fantasy, which uses a lot of contemporary effects and very interesting piece, I think. And that is a required performance for the free choice recital, which is the third stage. So everybody that makes it to the third stage will be performing the Michael Leiss work. And in addition, the Nightingale by Liszt, arranged by Henriette Renier, will also be a required piece in that free choice recital. And outside of those two pieces, they can play anything they want. And I think myself, this is one of the most telling stages to show a young artist's taste, musical taste, judgment, and, of course, their communicativeness in repertoire that they have chosen. So I think it's extremely exciting to hear these free choice recitals, and at least six to eight contestants will be allowed to pass to the third stage.
And you check their technical skills and, as you say, communication.
By then, yes, you almost would take that for granted.
Well, how many people start in the competition then?
We have accepted 50 contestants.
And you get them from word of mouth, from tapes, from actual hearing them, or what?
You know, Bob, as I travel around the world and see my colleagues at the World Harp Congress and these other kinds of events, I am amazed at the young people in the world. For 2 years, at least, they've been preparing Bloomington, the repertoire. So, I mean, we immediately, of course, all the conservatories, we send application forms and repertoire to all the leading schools of music and conservatories worldwide, the leading teachers. So, and of course, the trade journals also help a lot in getting the word out. But so, to me, that has always been a big thrill as I travel around the world to hear young people saying, oh, I'm going to Bloomington, I'm preparing Bloomington. And that's how I know the importance this has for a young artist aspiring for a solo career.
How many different countries are involved with these?
Many. You know, I don't have the count for this next coming competition, but I think there are always, 23, 25 countries represented. I know they will be coming from Russia and China and South America and most every country in Europe, England, France. And, of course, some Americans, Canadians.
talking big time now, aren't we?
Oh, we are, for sure, for sure.
There's an interesting story about the involvement of a fifth grade student of yours, of Claire McLaughlin. Can you just sort of share that with us?
Yes, this was such a sweet thing she did. I really never heard of anything quite like that. This little girl who has been commuting from San Francisco for lessons with me and works with my dear colleague in San Jose in between, she, instead of having a birthday party where her friends would bring her birthday presents, she had the idea that she would like to ask people to donate to the USA International Harp Competition. And mind you, this is in San Francisco. This is not in Bloomington. This is in San Francisco. So instead of getting computer games and dolls and toys and whatnot for her birthday, all of her friends and her friends' parents, they brought checks for the USA International Harp Competition. And so, of course, I think they raised over $1,000, which has now become a Claire McLaughlin prize.
And this is a 10-year-old girl or 11-year-old?
That's right. I think she's 11 now. But
and too young to be a competitor.
A contestant herself, right. That's right. But she loves the harp. She absolutely loves the harp and has felt very close to Indiana. She has come to many of my summer classes here and knows a lot of my college students and looks up to them, admires them, and has seen them compete in the USA International Harp Competition. And I think that's what really motivated her to do this.
I'm a layman. I have heard harps played with orchestras. I've heard solo recitals and so forth, but that's about all I know. And you said we have a number of instruments on campus, and then you talked about the first prize harp. Can you just tell us a little bit about the harp? I mean, I literally would like to get educated here.
Well, we do. We have a wonderful group of harps on campus here for the use of our students. A harp these days ranges in price from around $18,000 to maybe $30,000, depending on how much gold is on them, the gold leaf. The concert harp has 47 strings. The lowest ones are made of wire-bound steel, and the middle ones are sheep-cut. And the top very high strings are of a very fine quality of nylon. They are very patriotically colored red, white, and blue strings so that a harpist can tell the C's are red and the F's are blue and the rest of the strings are white. There are, I think, people are not aware of the fact that there are 7 foot pedals at the base of a harp. And each pedal has 3 notches. The top notch is a flat position, the middle notch is natural, and the bottom notch is sharp. And these pedals have only one function, and that is to raise and lower the pitch of the strings. So there is a C pedal, which controls the 7 octaves of Cs, and a D pedal controls all the Ds, and so forth. And they're attached to the base of the harp by heavy springs under great tension, that then are connected to pedal rods that go up that pretty column of the harp up toward the crown, and then they come down along the graceful neck of the harp where hundreds of levers and discs lengthen and shorten each string and therefore raise or lower the pitch as you move the feet pedals.
So you can tune to whatever key you're supposed to be playing in, more or less.
Right. For a harpist, it's just as easy to play in 7 flats as in 7 sharps. We simply set all the pedals beforehand. But where the complications come in is when you have chromatics. So, of course, the more chromatic a work is, the more pedal movements. For instance, one piece that I have often played is called the Danse des Lutins by my teacher Henriette Renier. And although it lasts only about 3 minutes, there are over 300 pedal changes. So the memory requirements for a harpist are very great because you can be playing the right notes, and if you forget one pedal or a pedal even slips on you, you can be in the wrong key, playing the right notes in the wrong key.
Well, it's much like an organ then, isn't it? In a sense, you have pedals and key changes and so forth. It's like pulling different stops.
Yes and no. It is... I think the footwork is somewhat similar to the organ, but where the organ, you're playing actual notes with your feet. What you, we're not supposed to hear the pedals of the harp even being moved, although sometimes you do hear them in a sensitive recording. But there is a lot of fancy footwork, and mostly people are not aware, I think, of the pedals.
So it looks graceful, but it's tough.
It's tough, right.
Okay. Why don't we hear some music now? I think let's take a little break. What would you suggest that we listen to?
Well, perhaps a piece that I think is deceptive. It sounds almost easy to play, rippling and gentle, by Gabriel Fauré, the Châtelaine en Satur, after a poem by Paul Verlaine.
Now, what should we be listening for in here?
In this piece?
Yeah.
Well, I think there are loads of pedals. They're just constant throughout, and that's what is deceptive, that one would listen to this and think, well, this is not a difficult piece. It's rather calm. But underneath this is going on a tremendous amount. It was a very chromatic piece and very difficult. I know some of my French colleagues pretend this is perhaps the most difficult solo.
We have just heard a selection by Fauré, performed by our special guest today, Suzanne MacDonald, Distinguished Professor of Harp at Indiana University. Suzanne, you won the big prize in Paris when you were 20, made your Carnegie Hall debut at 23. Now, how did this all come about from a girl from Rock Island, Illinois?
Well, I had a wonderful mother and father who started me on the harp when I was about 6 years old. My mother had played the harp for a year. And unfortunately for my parents, it was one of those things that got out of hand. They always said that in later years. I mean, I think they had a picture that I would be a kind of a dilettante harpist who would sit in the corner of the room and play, you know, pretty background music. But I fell in love with it right from the beginning. And my family, I have an older brother, my family, they loved to play bridge. And so it was the reverse of asking me always to go practice. It was just the opposite. I loved to practice. And my family would come and say, will you stop practicing and come and be a fourth hand for bridge? And this very young, I mean, I was playing bridge when I was 8 years old. So it was a real conflict of interest there. But then I've been so blessed by wonderful teachers in my life. And the first was Mrs. Franklin Peterson, who lived in Moline, Illinois. And she used to come to the house for lessons. And the first thing we would hear her, we had a Pekingese dog called Vivi. This was named after, I think, a war, something to do with the war, V for victory. And the first way I would know that Mrs. Peterson had arrived, I would hear her saying, Vivi! And she would come through the house, pick up the dog and love the dog. And she was like a member of our family, really, just a dear lady. And when I turned 13, she said, I think that, frankly, I really have taught you everything I know. And I would like to take you to Chicago to work with a teacher that I worked with, just had a few lessons with her. And I'd like to see that you get into her studio. And not only did she make the arrangement, but she took the train with me to Chicago for all of a year. I guess at that time I was 13. And so she would go with me, and we'd go up once a month. And I would go to the Lyon & Healy building, the corner of Wabash and Jackson in Chicago. and take lessons with Marie Ludwig. And Marie Ludwig had been second harpist with the Metropolitan Opera at a time when Carlos Salcedo was the principal harpist and Toscanini was the conductor. She then moved to Chicago, married a clarinetist with the Chicago Symphony. And she was a wonderful, very large German lady. And again, really, we became very, very close. And I worked with her right through those high school years until one summer when I was a junior in high school. She said, I'd like you to play for Mildred Dilling, who was at that time touring for Columbia Artists, had been for many years. One of her claims to fame was that she was Harpo Marx's teacher. And she was really the grand dame of the harp world in those days. And so I was very, very thrilled to play for Miss Dilling. And as she referred to it, it was a very famous lesson. Because in that lesson, she said, she invited me to study with her teacher, who was the great French harp pedagogue Henriette Regnier. Miss Dilling studied with her for 40 years. I mean, she went every summer to play her programs for Mademoiselle Regnier. So you can imagine I was, what, a 17-year-old girl? And what a thrill. I came home from the trip to Chicago and announced to my parents that I was going to France to study. Well, they were horrified. They were not pleased. They were horrified. And so then they had to find, Miss Dilling found a chaperone. And I went over to Europe my first time on a student ship. It took 11 days for the SS Nellie to sail from New York to Le Havre. And I was incredibly seasick most of the time. And when I arrived, though, in Paris and had my first lesson with Mademoiselle Regnier, I'll never forget it. I walked into her foyer. She had a lesson going on. And when that finished, and she opened the door and she came out and greeted me so affectionately, kissed me on both cheeks, and asked me that famous question, do you love the harp? And, of course, I stammered in my best French, oui, j'adore la harpe. And that started an incredible relationship. She was at that time 79 years old and not in the best of health, quite frail. But working with her that summer, and then the entire group of her students from all over the world, we all followed her to Etretat on the Normandy coast, where she had a villa next to the Gounod villa, that Charles Gounod's home there. And so I met, of course, a whole international group of harpists that studied with Mademoiselle Regnier in the summertime. But for me, I knew I had found my mentor. I came back, graduated from high school, and then approached my parents and said, I want to go back and study with Mademoiselle Regnier again. Well, this really was a blow to my parents because they had planned for me to attend an American university. Actually, my mother was a graduate of Mills College in Oakland, and she had always assumed I would go to Mills College. And so it was a problem, and they really didn't give permission, weren't happy about it until a week before school was to open. And I had to leave. And so I did get to go back, but it was not with my parents' blessing, really. They weren't happy about it. But it was a wonderful relationship. Mademoiselle Regnier had it was such incredible musicianship. She was such a marvelous musician, an incredible ear. Her idea of a good time was to go to the chamber music, the string quartet competitions at the Paris Conservatory, and write down, take dictation, four parts. And she had just a marvelous, marvelous ear. She has written some of the most demanding and exciting music for the harp, where really she captures marvelously the many colors that the harp is capable of.
You just gave me a marvelous segue into a piece of harp music that she's written. Can we do that?
Contemplation, one of her most famous pieces that she wrote for the dedication of a chapel in the south of France. Thank you.
We have just heard a selection played by Suzanne MacDonald, our special guest here, who is a distinguished professor of harp at Indiana University and is the artistic director for the USA International Harp Competition. Now, that was from one of your teachers, was that arrangement was made that we just heard?
That was an original composition by Mademoiselle Renier. She wrote some of the most difficult music I think ever written for the harp. And it's amazing because she was a very spiritual lady and a very tiny, petite person, but with a very fiery personality. And she wrote some of the most incredible pieces. Pieces, for instance, After the Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, this macabre murder story she set to music in the Ballade Fantastique. It's wild, wild music that she wrote and incredibly demanding for both technically and musically.
Well, that leads to a question. What are the major pieces that every harpist who wants to make a career in it should know?
Well, certainly the ones with orchestra, for example, which we call them, I do with my students, the Big Five, because now certainly the Handel Concerto in B-flat, the Mozart Flute and Harp Concerto in C, the Debussy Danse Sacrée et Profane, and the Introduction in Allegro by Ravel. Those four are musts, and now the Ginastera Harp Concerto has become so in demand that I feel every harpist needs to be able to play those.
What about solo works?
Solo works, there are so many, not always by composers that people would recognize, but of course Fauré wrote two pieces for the harp. Roussel wrote one solo piece for the harp. Dussek wrote many, many harp sonatas, and this is a key, I think, to name composers writing for the harp. He married a harpist, Sophia Cory, and because of that, he wrote a lot of music for the harp. Spohr wrote a lot of music for the harp because his wife also was a harpist, and he wrote some very difficult and beautiful two major solos and then a number of harp and violin works.
There's a Rodrigo concerto, too, isn't there?
Yes, Rodrigo wrote the Concerto Serenata, and then he arranged the Aranjuez, also for harp. And I know the composer's daughter quite well because she visited here, and she assures me that her father really feels it's very valid as a harp piece. And now that one also, I would say, is in great demand. Right after Ginastera is the Rodrigo Aranjuez for harp.
A minute ago, we talked about the people who were mentors for you. Can you share with us the people that you have mentored or have taught and where they are and what they're doing?
Well, I truly have been blessed by having some incredibly gifted students work with me. And even at the moment, there are some really great, great talents. As I look around the world, I see, and I'm so gratified that so many of them have wonderful positions. Some of them are among the leading concert harpists. Others are certainly among the leading teachers. And then an entire group are principal harpists with the major orchestras, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And it's exciting because as I travel everywhere, there are students of mine in all of these different cities.
Well, didn't you say you had the New York Philharmonic, the Metropolitan, the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony?
The Detroit.
Detroit.
Orchestra Nationale de France. Several on the West Coast. And then teachers, that students of mine who studied with me at the time when I left my affiliations on the West Coast. So those teachers are students of mine at USC and the University of Arizona, Cal State Los Angeles, and even Juilliard when I left Juilliard and came permanently here to Indiana.
That's quite a legacy. It's like having an extended family, isn't it?
Well, it is, really. And that's been one of the great joys is staying in touch with these young people who are now having incredible success.
Were you ever teaching both at Juilliard and Indiana at the same time?
Yes. For 5 years, I commuted between Bloomington and New York. I had an apartment there. And The strange thing about that, Bob, was that I felt it became harder to commute from here than it did. I commuted for 5 years from Los Angeles to Juilliard. But that used to be, I'd get on the red eye, I'd arrive in New York, and I'd go to my apartment, and I'd immediately take a nap. And then I'd start teaching around noon. And somehow, and I would stay a little bit longer. And then when I began doing it from Bloomington, it seemed it was harder for some reason getting to the Indianapolis airport, and it all became a little bit harder.
Okay, there's a concert harp, but we hear about an Irish harp, a Paraguayan harp. I mean, we hear about harps all over, lyres and all these. What are the differences for the layman?
Well, probably one of the biggest differences is size. So the concert harp, you know, is 6 feet tall, a big instrument with a large soundboard, while the Irish harp is a small instrument of, probably under 3 feet. There are no foot pedals on any of these other harps, so the repertoire that one can play on them is somewhat limited by the fact that we cannot do a lot of chromatics. Some harps, the Irish harp is one, they have levers, hand levers. So you can raise or lower the pitch of the strings, but only one at a time. One hand has to pluck the string, the other hand is turning the lever. You know, throughout history, there have been different harps. They tried a double-strung harp with two sets of strings crossed in the middle, a very cumbersome instrument without much sound. There are even triple-strung harps where there are three rows of strings and the inside set of strings were the chromatics. And picking your way among these three sets of string, also very cumbersome. The Paraguayan harp, I think, is an amazing instrument, though, because although no foot pedals, again, and actually no levers, so you're not changing pitches at all, but it's capable of the most incredibly intricate and fast rhythmical playing that can be done on the harp. Plus, the rounded soundboard, and rather thin, it's a very light instrument, very lightweight. So it's capable of a tremendously strong, loud bass. And I have studied it just a little bit with some of the leading one of the leading Paraguayan harpists. And I have students who play Paraguayan harp, too. And I find it a fascinating instrument and beautiful.
So you got to keep on top of what's going on around, don't you?
Well, there is an enormous group of people now playing folk harp of all different backgrounds.
Techniques of teaching and playing the harp. How do you teach the harp, the playing of it?
Well, I actually became, after these years with Mademoiselle Renier, I was perhaps her last major student before she died. I returned home after 2.5 years of work with her, and she died the next year. And in her lessons, which often I would be there for an hour lesson, and she would talk to me for 3 hours, she shared so much of her philosophy of teaching. And I became, I think it's safe to say, perhaps the leading exponent of her method during World War II when she was not able to teach. She, Leduc Publishing House in Paris asked her to write a harp method. And it became the Renier method in 2 volumes. And in it, she has such wise advice, such incredibly detailed analysis of the hand and the fingers, the arms, so not only the position, but the intricacies of harp playing, color, nuance, all these things. In she had the time to analyze her own playing to a great degree. And here I was, a young American girl, but who adored her teacher. And so I soaked it up. I really didn't question very much. I just soaked it up, and she poured it out. And it wasn't until I became more involved in teaching, although I always loved to teach, even when I lived in Rock Island, Illinois. During my junior and senior years of high school, I had 7 or 8 students there. So I taught basically all my life, I feel I've been teaching. And recently, with a colleague, Linda Wood Rullo, who lives in San Jose, we have written and published a new HAARP method based on many of the principles of the Renyer method, but one that we hope will be very, very good for harpists worldwide because it combines also a complete theoretical music theory instruction. We also wrote a large number of new HAARP solos and then the technical aspects. So it's called HAARP Olympics, and it's divided then into technical workouts, then drills, we call them, and those are games and theory exercises and instruction, and then solo rounds, we call it, and those are the solo pieces. And then at the end of every volume, and this is a 5-volume method, at the end there is a HAARP marathon, we call it. And this book is illustrated with teddy bears that were drawn by a wonderful Danish artist, illustrated this book. And at the marathon, it shows a teddy bear running around a track field. And in this part of the book, the student in one sitting has to play all the technical exercises, different now than what they had at the beginning of the book, and play 3 pieces by memory from the solo rounds and answer a lot of questions, theoretical questions. And then if they do that successfully, the teacher signs the certificate, and then they move on to the next volume. And it's having, I must say, tremendous success throughout the country. Teachers all over, I think, are using it because they don't have to buy, 10 different books. This one book can really take a harpist from the very, very beginning right up to really where they're playing quite advanced etudes.
You've been doing some work with Diane Bish here on campus. Is there anything that you've recorded that we could listen to?
Yes, we recorded a whole CD of sacred favorites for harp and organ. The organ has such an orchestral sound, so it's a beautiful combination, I think. And Diane invited me. I met her because she was she invited me to play on her television show taped at Fort Lauderdale, the Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church, where there's this great Rufati organ. And so many years, long before I knew her, she invited me down there to be a guest on her show. And we became friends. And I've taped many, perhaps 7 or 8 recitals with her for the Joy of Music.
Well, let's hear one. What would you suggest?
I think the Handel Largal would be very nice to hear.
We have just heard the Largo from Xerxes by Handel as played by organist Diane Bish and Suzanne McDonald, harpist, who is our guest today. Suzanne, you've been involved with the World Harp Congress, too, I believe.
Yes, I've been privileged since the beginning of this organization to be its artistic director. And what has been so wonderful is the friendships among colleagues all over the world. And among the things we do, we present a congress in different cities, different capitals of the world, every 3 years. Most recently, it was in Prague, in the Czech Republic, where almost 1,000 harpists attended, where there were incredible concerts every single night in one of the great concert halls in Prague. For example, with each orchestra, there would be three or four harp solos in an evening. And it was really one of the great events. But we have had these congresses in Paris, in Copenhagen, in Jerusalem. And each time, it truly is a chance to not only hear the finest among harp performance, but also to encourage young people. We have focus on youth concerts where 35, perhaps, are chosen by taped audition, young people, to go and perform at these congresses. So it is a great organization. I'm very proud to have been associated with it these many years.
And you've made a lot of it because of your association.
Well, I'm very happy to have been a part of this great, great event.
I'm sure every harpist in the world thanks you for your efforts. Suzanne, when a student comes to you and asks what are the most important lessons that they can learn, what do you tell them?
Well, you know, I think each student is so different. It would be very hard to generalize, but certainly they have to be very dedicated because the harp is such a digital instrument. I mean, you have got to really spend many, many hours practicing. So I think dedication. It's also a strange thing. I find it makes such a difference, even the quality of a person's skin. Some harpists just have a naturally beautiful tone quality, and this is such an important feature of harp playing. It really doesn't matter how good you are technically. If your sound is not beautiful, it's not a pleasant instrument to listen to. So some people even, of course, we have to develop calluses to protect the tips of our fingers. Otherwise, we would have a blister from practicing even 1 hour, much less 6 hours. But we have to keep those calluses filed and sometimes apply cream to keep them from getting too dry and hard, which gives a very harsh, dry sound. But the other thing I feel, there needs to be a quality of communicativeness. The harp can be a very boring instrument unless it's played with great, great, great skill. And one of the things why I say I can't generalize is I feel that everybody does have unique gifts in this area. And I feel my job as a teacher is to really bring out and enhance their natural gifts so that one person might be a very quiet, introverted student, but a dynamo when they're on that stage. They're like a horse out of the stable, and they play with this great passion and excitement. While another person may be, very extroverted and kind of happy-go-lucky personality, and they too have a different approach, but also one that is going to really bring them great results, very charismatic as a performer. And I think that is, if I have a secret of my teaching, it is to encourage and to enhance the very real gifts that people have.
Communication you mentioned very early on in this interview, and that's what, when you communicate your love, your passion.
Because really I tell my students, it doesn't matter what you do in your practice room. I mean, we're not training to play in a practice room. It's how are you playing, how are you going to relate to people and share with an audience? How do you project in a big hall? That's what counts.
So that's the great truth.
I think it does come down to that. Because from all different backgrounds, from all different personalities, I've certainly had students who have had tremendous success.
We have a piece by Jacques Ibert that you've played that we'd like to end our discussion with.
He wrote several solo pieces for the harp, but I think one of his most loved and frequently heard pieces is the Entr'acte for flute and harp. And so I've enjoyed playing a lot of chamber music in my career, and I think this piece often is used as an encore, and I enjoy it, and I hope Your listeners will too.
And that's with Louise DiTullio, flute, and Suzanne McDonald, harp. Our guest today has been Suzanne McDonald, Distinguished Professor of Harp at Indiana University Bloomington, and the founder-director of the USA International Harp Competition, which is held every 3 years on the 4th of July. This just happens to be one of those three-year periods. You have been listening to Profiles, where we meet the person behind the persona. Our guest today has been Suzanne McDonald, Distinguished Professor of Music at Indiana University and one of the great harpists of our time. Suzanne, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Bob.
This is Bob Willard. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in May of 2001, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.